Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So as we consider our meditation practice, it's helpful to recollect that the most common word that the Buddha used for that is bhavana, which means, literally means bringing into being, cultivation, development. And to learn how to be attentive to what is it that we're bringing into being, so that we're learning how to focus on bringing into being qualities of wholesome, skillful mental states as opposed to the unwholesome or unskillful. Bringing into being calm rather than agitation, restlessness. Bringing into being clarity rather than confusion. So that just taking that into account, and that just because what comes up in the mind, if we're not attentive to that, is it's pretty random. Our minds are pretty unreliable. So that our bhavana, our cultivation, our development, we have to be alert and attentive to what we're actually cultivating as a habit of mind, as a focus of mind. That learning about these different pulls and pushes within the mind. Also, just reflecting on the word that is used in the Thai language a lot certainly the forest teachers Ajahn Chah would be patibat, which is means like to train or to do, just sort of engaging oneself and to putting forth effort, and certainly really being attentive to recognizing these different moods of the mind, because it's the internal shifting of the mood, shifting of obsessions, really. We get obsessed with something that we're really excited about, elated about, infatuated with, and then all of a sudden it shifts to something we're irritated or upset by, or some obsessed with some sort of particular view or opinion, so that to be able to recognize what's actually happening. And this is why the importance of the nature of the Dhamma, when the Buddha says, open aiko, then we do the chanting of open aiko, being named to this quality of the Dhamma, in that it's leading inwards. So we have to keep drawing attention inwards, internalizing our practice, learning how to be with an object of attention, say, like taking the breath. That's the most common meditation technique, mindfulness of breathing. Certainly in the Buddhist world, and in the scriptures themselves, that's the most common methodology that the Buddha gives. So that learning to pick up the breath as an object, learn how to bring that attention inwards, tuning into the rhythm of the breath, the texture of the breath, the nature of the breath, and allowing that to become increasingly clear and having a consistency of attention with the breath, and then paying attention to the shifts and changes that are going to take place. I mean, it's sometimes the mind becomes calm and still, and then it changes. And sometimes there's, it's restless and kind of obsessed, and it changes. But to be willing to pick up the breath and stay with that object of attention, to be interested in the breath, and not in the sense of fixing attention and trying to contain the mind and force the mind onto the breath, but allowing the breath to be a vehicle whereby we can allow that awareness and attention, that quality of knowing, to become more consistent, more steady, and more clear. As we use the breath as an object of attention, use the breath as the meditation, the breath also has to mirror the different path factors as well, in the sense that this practice is not, say, the Buddhist practice of the teaching of the Buddha, the path that the Buddha gives us, it's not just a meditation technique. It's a coming together and unification of these different path factors of sila, of virtue, of integrity, of a clarity of our actions of body and speech, our livelihood, our way of being in the world, and the different aspects of unification of the different path factors of, of samadhi itself. There's effort, there's mindfulness, there's a settling of the mind, and of the investigation, the contemplation, the discernment. And these need to work together, they need to function together. They need to, to not be, out of sync with each other or dissonant. They need to harmonize and unify, so that as we're paying attention to the breath as an object of meditation, then to be attentive to the same pushes and pulls that pull us out into the world or pull us into the world of our memories, the world of our projections, how our actions and speech affect that, how our our energy, our effort, our exertion, how does that affect it? What's the effect of the feeling of the of attention, the feeling of the settling of the mind. How does it unify? How does it work together? How does our body, speech, and mind work together so that it fosters this quality of clarity? So that as we continue to develop our practice, then it's that these factors of the path of practice, path of training, they work together, they mature together, and that unification is not just a unification of mind, concentration, one-pointed, internal. It's a unification of all the different aspects of our practice and our life, so that this path is it matures together, so that learning how to pay attention to that kind of maturing process, our taking responsibility of our actions and speech, taking responsibility of, where's our attention go? What do we get lost in or caught up in terms of the sense doors? What are the that restraint of the senses? Do we understand how our senses affect the quality of clarity within the mind? Are we doing it out of when it suits us, and when there's something that stimulates a particular strong like or dislike, it all falls apart. So there's this quality of consistency in practice is really important, and that consistency, a willingness to train body, speech, and mind. Consistency in applying attention and effort, and that quality of consistency is, it's not so easy. It's easy to say, but it's more difficult to really apply that and be consistent, because our moods keep changing, our likes and dislikes keep impinging on us, so that that consistency, steadiness in practice is something that Ajahn Chah really emphasized a lot. And inevitably, there's going to be some fluctuation. There's going to be some ebbs and flows of energy and interest and enthusiasm. But that internal consistency of bringing the objects of attention under the purview of mindfulness and discernment, satipanya, is that sense of that awareness and investigation are functioning. Remember Ajahn Chah just giving the example in terms of the importance of consistency, just saying, it's like you plant a tree, and you water it for a bit, put some fertilizer on, and then 3 or 4 days later, you decide to move it, and pick it up, move it over to some other place, put it there, and you replant it, get it settled there. So okay, a few more days pass. Dig it up, move it again, and say what is going to be the result of that? It's going to die. And said, that's what happens to our practice when we're we sort of do it for a while, then do something else, and get distracted, put it down. Pick it up again for a bit. There's the necessity of having a consistency. You know, and it's natural that there's going to be, as I said, there's going to be fluctuations, ebbs and flows of certain elements in our practice, but that internal reflection, that internal application of awareness and investigation, mindfulness and wisdom, that's where our consistency has to arise from, you know, and circumstances around us inevitably change. It's how we receive it and carry it, hold it. How do we hold it? It's like externally, we talk about the eight worldly winds, praise and blame, gain and loss, acceptance, rejection, happiness and suffering. Those are the world is constantly reacting to those basic worldly winds. But we do the same thing internally as well. We react to praise and blame. There's this running commentary in our mind so often of are we patting ourselves on the back for how we've done this practice, done that practice, held our practice for so long? Or we're getting upset at ourselves, frustrated at ourselves, blaming ourselves because we're not following how we would like to be doing or how we think we should be doing. So there's this internal commentary, the gain and loss. We have a good meditation, and it's really we're really sort of okay. Practice is really blazing now. We're going to get somewhere now, and then the mind changes as is normal, or it's just not as exciting as it was before, and this is loss. Isn't this terrible? Or isn't it awful? And we have the same internal, that acceptance, rejection. Normally it would be like sort of status, lack of status. But then we do, we judge ourselves in the same way. And these are the same worldly winds, how we react to our internal world as we do to the world and the circumstances around us, happiness and suffering, where we give ourselves really good points when we get some happiness and we get pleasurable feeling and sensation, and when there's a bit of difficulty, a bit of distress arise, and sort of the feeling of the end of the world. So that to recognize all these worldly winds. And our duty as practitioners, that bhavana, bringing into being sati and punya, mindfulness and discernment, attention and investigation, that's what we bring into being. And when we cultivate that, develop that, that's where there begins to be a unification and a maturing within our practice. And it's always, paying attention to that quality of the Buddha saying, teach us two things, dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. It's a modest goal, a modest proposal. But you start realizing how important that is, essential, and how liberating it is when we can recognize, what is it that brings up this feeling of dissatisfaction, dis-ease, discontent, stress, suffering? And the Buddha is always pointing to this quality of clinging, that clinging attachment And what we can be doing is letting go. It's like Ajahn Chah would always say, all you need to do is just know clearly and let go. It's that knowing and letting go, knowing and letting go. And when we build on that simple act of directing attention to the quality of knowing, and then releasing, relinquishing, letting go, putting down the burden. Because you start seeing that what we do, we burden the mind, with happiness. We burden the mind with suffering. We burden the mind with gain. We burden the mind with loss. We burden the mind with praise. We burden the mind with blame. We're burdening the heart. But we can let go of that, and that's that opportunity to unburden ourselves and allow this space and clarity to arise. These simple movements of mind, the simple impulse to being and becoming, where we're taking on and holding fast to a mood, learning how to let it go, picking up and holding to a position, a view, an opinion, learning how to let that go, and picking up a sense of identity, of self, of me. That's really burdening the mind. And just learning to let that go, to put it down. And that sense of doing and letting go, knowing and letting go. It isn't that we don't do anything. And it's also that sense of, it isn't that, we don't do anything at all. Because we have to learn how to put forth effort to cultivate the factors of the path. We have to learn how to pick things up skillfully, employ them, utilize them, but not let them be a burden. Not letting the meditation be a burden. Picking up the object of meditation and allowing a clarity and brightness of mind to arise. Because it's when there's a consistency of attention without clinging to, holding to an obsession of worry or fear or desire to get, to gain, to be, to become, then there's a brightness and spaciousness that naturally arises. How do we, there's that sense of picking it up and holding it in a way that isn't crushing it, isn't sticky, and letting it follow its course. And of course, there's a well-known story of one of Ajahn Chah's disciples who heard Ajahn Chah teaching about letting go, and a big storm came, blew the roof off half of his kuti, and he just left it like that. And Ajahn Chah saw it, and whose kuti is this? Whose cabin is this? And asked in the middle of the sangha, "It's me." The monk puts his hand up, and why didn't you fix your roof? He said, "Well, I'm practicing letting go. You keep teaching us to let go." And Ajahn Chah blasted him for that. The poor monk was really confused, because here I'm practiced letting go to this extent, and I still get criticized and blamed. Why? So there's appropriate times to pick things up and engage and employ and rely on, and that's where picking up the meditation object. Picking up the reflection, but not in a way of obsessing or burdening mind? How do we do it so that we can relinquish clinging, relinquish attachment, relinquish that tendency to that unwholesome desire, that sense of when we're doing something, you know, not trying to gain, to get, to be, become, to identify me and my practice. There's a really nice idiom in the Thai language, and it's more around actions, external actions, but the spirit of it applies internally as well. And since there's the idiom is putting gold leaf on the back of the Buddha, is that normally that you know, you get you know, go to a shrine. And oftentimes they have, they have Buddhas there, and people you take gold leaf or you purchase gold leaf, and of course, and it's a meritorious action to put the gold leaf on the Buddha, and you just want to put it on some prominent spot where everybody can see where you put it, but to put it on the back of the Buddha. Is a way of, it's doing something wholesome and good, but it's not advertising it or not getting caught up in the result of what it is. So that's an external action, but it's also an internal. So we want to holding practice in a way where, we're putting the effort into the doing, but the letting go is the spirit that we're holding it in. So this practice of ours is this fundamental spirit of doing and letting go, knowing and letting go, paying attention to the, am I engaging with alertness and awareness? But am I releasing and relinquishing at the same time? Am I unburdening the heart rather than burdening it? I'll offer that for reflection this evening.